thinking behind these comments so that you have in mind images partially from Henry's talk last night, partly from a group of images that Kevin Hartman has collected from the various participants on this panel. First is an overview. Hope 6 fundamentally changed the way in which government at all levels, but particularly the federal government, gets involved in the building of cities and the life of neighborhoods and the people in these communities. It took a program which had, in effect, funded spaceships, alien spaceships, to be dropped into the middle of neighborhoods, not exactly unannounced, not exactly uninvited, but certainly unannounced and uninvited to the majority of people whose lives were affected by them. And those spaceships, by the 1980s and certainly by 1992, when Henry Cisneros came to the administration in Washington, had become some of the worst problems facing America. I know it's hard to believe, but in 1992, urban was still a four-letter word. And the most degraded and least valued parts of our regions tended to be the centers of cities. And the worst parts of these worst parts of regions in the public perception were the public housing projects, which, though lofty in ambition at the beginning, had turned into nightmares. The Hope 6 program did not drop any more spaceships into neighborhoods, but rather used its funding to create a program in which, from the grassroots up, communities determined a kind of planning and vision for their community, and as it evolved, the Hope 6 funding was tailored to respond to that vision that was created in a public process. This is a complete reversal of attitude, and it has resulted in a series of extraordinary revitalizations and redevelopments around the country. We just learned this morning, and I have to get my numbers because it's hot off the presses, that a total of 236 grants were given in 127 cities. There was, over the course of the program, from beginning in 1992 through to 2006, roughly $5 billion of federal money has been invested in the program. But what's more important is that five times that amount has been leveraged in private investment, local grants, foundation contributions of various sorts. It's a very wise use of public investment. There are several key parts to the program to be talked about, and the panelists will do that. I'm only going to list what they were. Over breakfast, I got a huffy reply. Well, are you going to say this, or are we going to say this? So I'm just going to give you the topics. It seems to me the process of engaging, the requirement to have a process of engaging residents of public housing projects, neighbors of public housing projects, people in the communities within which they are located, the local government agencies in which serve them, and, most importantly, private development interests in it, is one of the most extraordinary outcomes of this. And in some cases, the process itself created a vehicle for cities to begin working through problems. There's no question that the positive impact, second point, of these projects has been to regenerate the quality of the areas around them and increase their capacity for revitalization. It was deliberately set up as a mixed-income, mixed-tenure program in order to deconcentrate poverty and create sustainable communities. It's a marketing challenge. To the prospective homeowners, the marketing challenge was, come invest your life savings in a site with 40 years of bad newspaper headlines in order to live next to public housing residents. Not exactly what the real estate market was doing, but it has worked and succeeded. The social support systems to effect this transition evolved in the course of it, and they were another important component. So if those were the components, I'm going to ask the panelists to take a few minutes and tell us what they believe to be the most important positive lessons that they learned from this experience and would do again? And what are the most important negative lessons that they learned and would not do again? I had proposed that they take 5 minutes to do that. They responded unanimously that that was too much time. So they're going to try to do it in 3 minutes to do that. And then we'll have a little back and forth among the panel for another few minutes. Then the third question is going to be, how does this inform the next step? How does this inform creating mixed income, mixed development communities in any site, whether it's in the city or not? How does it affect your capacity to be involved in creative redevelopment and regeneration of neighborhoods? Well, I now would like to briefly introduce the panel, all of whom have been intimately involved in this program. Shortly after Henry Cisneros signed the charter in Charleston, he challenged us as an organization to provide services to HUD that would inform and educate the program. A group of us went to Washington at HUD to meet with him, and we were ushered into a room with about 40 people, I think, Henry, around a table. Looked like 50, but maybe it was only 20. But anyway, so a huge number of people who were all the top-level bureaucrats of HUD. And there was Henry, just as he is now, with his jacket off. Tie was loosened, I think, at that point. And we were coming into the middle of a discussion, which he stopped and then introduced us and we did our thing. What was extraordinary for those of us with experience in government offices and similar meetings is that Henry conducted an almost university graduate level like a brainstorming session with all of his staff, raising ideas, engaging the staff, responding to what they were saying, and I thought, wow, this is going to be fantastic, because the program was being led by someone who was interested in seeing how to expand what was then known about these kinds of programs. So, Henry, it's a delight that you're here to continue that same role, conduct another session here, and engage in this dialogue. We're most grateful for it. Paul Brophy was, before becoming a consultant on these matters, head of the Enterprise Foundation organization, dedicated to finding ways of not only providing housing, but social services and improving educational opportunities and the quality of life for people in communities. He was there at the beginning, was one, along with Richard Barron and a few others, one of the key people in inventing sort of these financial wizards who go into rooms and look into mirrors and come up with these fantastic ways of combining and pooling resources. What's most interesting about Paul is he sees it, that kind of technique, in the context of not only the social needs, but the physical needs, the program. So Paul was there at the beginning, and we're glad that he's here today. Peter Calthorpe, who you all know, was really the reason we met Henry in the first place, had worked with Henry on looking at ways in which individual programs could be seen in a more comprehensive light. So instead of focusing just on housing, you're looking at the overall needs of a city to see how programs could fit into that, and out of that came the opportunity to proceed with the Hope Six program. And of course, Peter's been involved in designing and building some Hope Six programs ever since. Tom Gallus is the principal of Torti Gallus, who've done something like 39 Hope Six projects. 32. Henry asked me how many we did, I won't say. But anyway, it's more than 33. But we'll have it out later on that. But the experience that firm has had has been across the country, and very valuable indeed. And I've saved to last Chickie Grayson, the president and CEO of Enterprise Homes, an organization again within the sort of group of enterprise companies that. Deal both with housing and with the social services that support it. Before I do that, I'm going to thank Kevin Hartman, who's the Vice President of Development at Kimball Hall Urban Centers, LLC in Chicago, also a company that has done a great many Hope Six programs, and to whom we're all grateful for co-chairing this event with me and who has made all of this possible. So thank you, Kevin, in advance, and we'll thank you at the end for doing that. So, Chicky, you are close to our nation's capital there in Columbia, Maryland.
It had part of the...
And we thought that one of the things we ought to do to set the stage for this discussion is to give you an update on the status of the Hope 6 program as it is now. As you know, it thrived mightily until the year 2000, and then something mysterious happened, and it went away for a while. We won't go into details of that. And now it's resurfacing again, and it would be nice to know what the latest is. Chicky.
Thank you. Thank you, Ray. And it's really an honor to be here today with so many of my heroes for urban redevelopment. The Hope 6 program under Henry's reign and beyond that really provided a significant amount of funding to make the redevelopment possible for distressed public housing. Since that time, the program still does exist, but at a very, very minor level. There are two bills that have been introduced into Congress, one in the House and one in the Senate. The one in the House has actually passed. Some of the things that make it different from before, and you'll hear some of this in the discussion today, so we'll provide a backdrop for that, is the issue of one-to-one replacement and ensuring that there is a one-to-one replacement for all existing public housing units on a Hope 6 development. And that had been an area of controversy during the time of the Hope 6 program. Also, there's a significant emphasis on relocation and trying to help people get into areas that have a lower concentration of poverty. A significant emphasis continued on community and supportive services. That was certainly in the first Hope 6 legislation and in the regulations, and that continues into this new bill. Increased resident involvement, and also to be noted that several tenants currently coming into a new Hope 6 redevelopment may have to pass some requirements, for example, for credit and issues related to drugs and incarceration. This particular bill that was passed by the House, you can't use any of those strict standards for allowing people to come back into the housing. And it also has a strong green communities component that was pushed by Enterprise, I'm proud to say. So that one passed. In the Senate, it's in committee, hasn't passed. That one has a much more significant connection with the schools. They really want to see a local partnership with the local school district within the community that's being built. They also want to make sure that there's significant leveraging requiring 5% coming from local governments. And everything else is pretty similar to what the House bill is with regard to relocation and one-to-one replacement. It's not likely to pass in this current session. It's a shorter session because of the elections. There are issues that are higher on the agenda: foreclosures, GSEs, and FHA. The House has passed 30 housing bills this session. The Senate has passed none. So I think it's probably pretty safe to say that that bill would not be moving forward, which is really an opportunity. Part of the discussion we hope to have today is what should that legislation look like. So that's where that stands currently.
So there's hope for revival.
Absolutely. There definitely will be a revival.
Will it be Hope 6 or
no.
Hope 7?
There will be another version.
Ah, okay. Great. Thank you.
That's my prognosis.
Okay. You heard it here first. You heard it here first. Right. Very good. Okay, well, now move to the three-minute summaries in which panelists will say what they thought worked best and what they thought didn't work so well. The balance of the group by acclamation allocated Henry 5 minutes, since he's got the most to say, for all of us to hear. So, Henry, please.
Ray, thank you for agreeing to chair this panel as well as for the wonderful work you've done. The reality of Hope 6 is out in the country. It's in communities. And folks like Ray and the others up here have done this in physical space, and it's a beautiful thing to see, as you can see pictures from these slides up here. I will try to hold to the 3 minutes and because it's important that we go through this cycle and then have the conversation that follows. The Hope 6 program was a response to a national commission called the National Commission on Distressed Public Housing, which concluded that out of the 1.2 million units existing in the public housing program in the country, some huge number of those, like 40%, were virtually uninhabitable, were so distressed that they were severely distressed. The effort resulted from a series of experiments that preceded it, but the focus here became tear down the worst, these awful high-rises, some of which you see photographed up here, and replace them with something that works. It was a happy convergence of circumstances that the new urbanists would be at work putting together the prototype projects, the first projects that suggested to some of us, this is what we want on those sites. Let me quickly try to respond to Ray's point about some positive outcomes and some negative outcomes as we reflect on the program over time. Quickly, positive outcomes. First is this, are the design-related questions. We learned that these traditional lower-density individual buildings of an appropriate scale work in cities. And we should have known that instinctively from Jane Jacobs and all the other work on diversity and scale and so forth, but Hope 6 proved that we can remake cities in this way. We can recycle entire neighborhoods with appropriate design. Secondly, it was important to learn that mixed income and mixed uses are really critical concepts, that people can live together, that it sort of works as a concept. Places like Centennial in Atlanta, prove it up in spades. So that's a second lesson. A third is that it's important to create mechanisms for public and private financing, that we could bring private financing to projects like this and leverage up the public dollars and really do projects of scale. $35 million of federal money would result in projects of $200 million of redevelopment. Fourthly, that the concept of decentralization of the poorest populations, though really not an original element of the program and not uncontroversial, proves an important thesis that accumulating the poorest of the poor with few role models, little economic uplift, lacking in support services is not a way to end poverty, but that putting people near where jobs are and creating positive environments does work. And that was an important lesson from this. Fifth, that support services matter and that the best Hope Sixes have been those that include renovations to schools, job training programs, health centers, public libraries, community space, ball fields, recreational centers, as part of a real village, an urban village with a center that has these public amenities and public uses. And finally, cities learned lessons about how they could recycle neighborhoods, attract investment, and areas that were once kind of sinkholes for negative energies suddenly become magnets for new investment and new possibilities in the city. So those are all positive things that came from it. Real quickly, two kind of negative experiences. One is that this issue of one-for-one replacement exists because it highlights one of the problems of Hope 6, which is that not sufficient hard units were built to provide housing for the people who were in the units before. Now, that's a major problem for me. It's a kind of a conscience issue for me because as Secretary of Housing, my first job should have been to provide better housing for people. The truth of the matter is that many of these units were vacant. These big high-rises were nearly vacant, so you can't just count the number of units in there and say that's how many units we needed to replace. And then there's a logical problem. How do you reduce density if you must commit to bringing 2,000 people back to the same square footage, the same acreage as what was there before? So there are two issues. One is, do you provide housing for those folks who were there with vouchers, which are not hard units, but vouchers that let them live elsewhere, or must you commit to building the hard units? And if so, can you build the hard units somewhere else? Housing authorities are notoriously poor at building new units on new sites because the NIMBY problems of getting public housing built anywhere. So there's a real conundrum there. I think what the record will show is that Section 8 vouchers were used, and many people did well. They moved to areas where they had better jobs, better education for their children. But Section 8 vouchers are not without problems of discrimination in the suburbs, of the difficulty of allocating units for this purpose. And the advocates for the poor will tell you Section 8 vouchers are no substitute for hard units, because Section 8 vouchers can disappear with the strike of a pen in the budget, and hard units are committed to poor people. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the negative issues that have to be worked through here. I think on the whole, the program, you know, commends itself as positive for the upside, and many of the negative things can be worked through, but I would not suggest that we've worked through them yet. There's still work to be done on this agenda.
Right.
Thank you. Paul Brophy, you were there early on, have watched it follow through. What are your thoughts about successes and problems?
Ray, I would frame this as follows. I think the Hope 6 fits into a broader discussion on mixed income. There's another phenomenon underway, which is the inclusionary housing work that's going on in strong areas. I think both of those are saying the following. One, that I think we learned, the headline is that what we learned from Hope 6 and the inclusionary zoning so far is that mixed income housing can work. People can live together side by side with radically different incomes, cultures, backgrounds. That's an important new dimension of American planning, American design, American development. But within that, I think there's some elements we've got to focus on that are positive and there are lessons. First, in order for that to happen, we need to follow long-established real estate principles. Good design, good management, and within the good design, as you're seeing from these slides, you want to have the units of various income levels indistinguishable from the exterior. You want to have the project, the community, fit into the neighborhood. And you need to use public space creatively and also integrate the units so that you don't have the lower income units segregated from the higher end units. So point one, I think we've learned that those principles need to be followed. Second, I think there's a lesson we've learned about trying to connect mixed income housing into markets. The Hope 6 experience is typically working in places that were very weak markets because the public housing itself was distressed and problematic. But I think what we're learning is that the unit mix can vary depending on market strength. If I've got a very strong market situation, I can bring in more low-income units there and still attract market rate people than I can if I have a very weak situation. And I worry at times when I hear people saying, well, a third, a third, a third, which is kind of the language in this business, becomes a one-size-fits-all when, in fact, we're trying to craft the mix based on market conditions. Third lesson I think we've learned is that, and the research seems to be saying this, that part of the aspiration of the Hope 6 program was based on the premise that if we have low-income people live outside of an all-poor area, and we create these kind of environments that are mixed income and attractive, that merely bringing people of low-income nature living side by side with people of a higher income nature is enough to break the cycle of poverty. That has not yet been proven. I think what we're seeing in the experience so far is that there are conscious efforts necessary in order to help low-income people move beyond their poverty, even when they're living in mixed-income contexts. It's easier to do, but still requires some level of social service delivery. Last point I'd make is I think that the side-by-side living also needs a boost. Henry's point related to play areas and recreation and activities, but a conscious effort on the part of the residents and the owners to build community. I live in Jim Rouse's Columbia, Maryland. When Jim first started that large-scale mixed-income community, he hired people to start the first Boys Club and Girl Scouts and Soccer League and so on, so that what the sociologists call social capital was created. That also needs to be factored into the budgets and the planning and the operations of the Hope 6 and the other mixed income developments elsewhere. If there's a negative I think needs to be corrected, is that, and as we watch the Hope 6 program evolve, Chickie, there's still too much brain damage in making these happen. This is a crazy process. It takes too long. It's too expensive. There are too many steps. There are too many hidden variables. There are too many unknowns. In part, what we've done is taken a private model, grafted it onto a long-standing public housing model that's filled with regulations that don't make it easy for the two to work together. And my sense is that we, if we're going to have this program really operate at scale and bring in substantial numbers of high-quality developers, we need to reduce that friction in order to make it easier for good development to happen. It also helps develop a stronger political constituency when it doesn't take 7 years between the time the project's conceived and the time you get action coming out of the ground. So I'd like to talk about how to fix that. Thanks.
Peter Calthorpe, you were not only involved in the beginning, but involved in many projects and continue to work on projects like this. What are your thoughts?
Just a few brief ones. I won't recount all the great successes because I think that they're kind of obvious at this point. Although I do think it would be really valuable. I know Henry's working on a book. When the data, the hard data, the results of this program are made public, and that really hasn't been made, and it's a lot of word of mouth at this point. So I'd say one of the challenges is to actually get the analysis and the results of this out. And I'm not going to answer your questions. I'm actually going to talk about something else, which is that we're going to have a – how surprising. Look, we're about to get a new administration. What would be – if we could play God for a while, what would be the programs that we would advocate? What would we do? I guess that's lessons learned moving forward. It seems to me that one of the things that Henry brought, which is not talked about enough, brought to HUD – because we tend to focus on Hope 6 because of this physical buildings and real projects. But we're a whole series of other programs that I think are really at the heart of dealing with affordable housing in America today. One of them was moving to opportunity. And, Henry, I hope you'll say more about it as we move on. But, you know, Hope 6 was highly dependent on Section 8 vouchers. And there's a lot of questions about Section 8 vouchers. The question is, can they live on through political turmoil? Well, I think that can be resolved. Maybe they need endowments or something where there's a fixed source of income so it's not at the whim of Congress to give or take them. I think what's more worrisome about the Section 8, which really is the ground upon which the Hope 6 programs live or die and any other serious affordable housing approach, is what their flaws in terms of can low-income households really go out into the marketplace and find the housing to use the vouchers on? Mm-hmm. Is there too much discrimination? Are there places that are just too far? And how does a low-income inner-city household move to a suburb that has good schools and job opportunities when they don't know anybody there, when there's no social infrastructure for that? Well, Henry went and tried to solve that with his Moving to Opportunity program. And we don't talk about that program enough, and I don't know enough about what really happened with it. But certainly, to me, that would be the basis of the next steps. Where do we go from here? Which would be some reinvention and actually repowering of the Moving to Opportunity. It's a regional vision. It's a notion that you can't solve housing issues in individual jurisdictions. You have to deal with it at a regional scale. Which leads me to another thing, which is that right now your federal highway dollars are often tied to meeting air quality standards. So there's, you know, the dollars that come from the federal level to the state and local level are tied to performance in other arenas. It seems to me that federal housing dollars in whatever form should be tied to requiring states to come up with coherent regional plans that really put teeth into fair share housing. Until all the jurisdictions in regions shoulder their proportion of the burden, not just because it's fair, but because that's what low-income households need, is the opportunity to move into or move around and move to opportunity, as Henry framed it. It seems to me that's a program that the CNU should be advancing. It sounds complex, but those two things, which is, one, to have a moving to opportunity program that really solves most of the problems of Section 8, and secondly, to have federal programs that demand that the states and the regions actually instigate fair share housing policies so that various cities can't engage in exclusionary zoning practices. Those two things, I think, go to the heart of the matter. And, you know, in a way, as important as it was, rebuilding the public housing is something that was done and needs to be finished. But the future agenda, I think, lies in these two other programs.
Great. Okay. Kevin Hartman, you're involved in development of some Hope 6 projects. What's your take on what's worked for you and what needs to be worked on?
Well, as everyone said, I'll keep this short. We're most proud of, I'll speak on a very narrow basis and then apply it to what I think is one of the major successes of Hope 6. We're developing a large site in Cabrini Green, and I believe what we're selling to the market probably has the highest price per square foot of any Hope 6 development in the country. We're selling townhomes. Thank you. We're selling townhomes that are $700,000-$800,000, penthouse condo units that are $600,000-$700,000. And we're changing the language that people are using to describe urban places. Ray, you're no marketer, thank God, by what you said before. We can't say that to a buyer. But what we can say is we're creating the next great Chicago neighborhood, in the case of Chicago. There's great Chicago neighborhoods, Uptown, Rogers Park, Hyde Park. And what we needed to do was celebrate what we were doing to change people's perception about what urbanism was, what diversity meant, and we were very upfront about what the place was. Everyone knew Cabrini Green is notorious. The larger benefit of Hope 6, I'm going to leave my comments just to this, is that it's changing people's perception, has changed people's perception of what neighborhoods are. Diversity actually means, not in the trite sense, but in the fullest sense, what people want to celebrate, what communities are, neighborhoods are. We see it on the ground floor, and as you see these images, who wouldn't want to live in these communities?
Well, I think what you're getting at, what I believe to be the greatest response to that marketing challenge, not marketing tag, by the way, but marketing challenge that I articulated at the beginning, is when you're creating a great neighborhood, that is the answer. That is the way it works, but it has to be convincing. Tom Gellis, your experience.
I just want to say what an honor it is to be part of this distinguished panel. We couldn't have done the work we've done as a firm without the seeds having been planted that you all did. So thank you very much. I want to pick up, Kevin, on your point about some of the positive things. The way I saw Hope 6 is it really transformed neighborhoods from market failures to viable, market successful neighborhoods. This is something that the private market could not and would not have ever done on its own. It was too expensive, it was too risky, and there was no way that these kind of transformations could have occurred without the Hope 6 program. I think our firm, in working through all the projects, had a range of successes and failures, and some were singular in that there may have only been one where we had, say, for instance, a real transformation, social, physical, economic, such as the Martin Luther King Plaza, where there was really a partnership between the city, the developers, the federal government, and the community. And without that, and it took 12 years to pull that off, but it really did happen. I think another singular kind of success for us was in the area of environmental sustainability, a project in Tacoma, Washington called Salishan, where we were able to really address something that Hope 6 really wasn't pushing, which was, and now will be, thanks to Chicky and the efforts of the committee, environmental sustainability, addressing not only the conservation of natural resources, but think about it, the cost of fuel and so forth, and how people trying to live in affordable housing can afford that when their costs of living are so high. I have several negative lessons that I think are important. Paul talked about the brain damage, and I see it as an expectation that Hope 6 had, that there was a unified infrastructure to do these kinds of projects. Think about it. We needed developers who could do low and affordable housing and understand that world, rental and for sale. We needed market rate developers who wanted to come into an urban environment and take risks, market rental and for sale. We needed community and social services providers, property managers, and homeownership and credit counselors, all to come together into a team that really didn't exist. And so we found we were dealing with primarily developers who were used to doing tax credit deals, or they were market rate developers. So they didn't easily cross over, and the infrastructure really wasn't there in some cases. And now we're advocating things like more comprehensive things like ties to schools and education and addressing crime and health care and, environmental expertise. And so we're adding more layers of complication and expertise that's going to be needed. And so one thing for sure in whatever new program comes out, it's going to need to have time for the teams to form in a way that 90 days doesn't quite do it, to form a team, come up with a concept, and have a winning proposal that addresses this comprehensive approach. I think another failure of Hope 6 in almost all of ours, I remember as designers, we have felt that the marketplace and our developer clients in many cases did not recognize the market potential of these revitalized communities. They underestimated again and again. The so-called market analysts and the people that focus on valuing properties and so forth and were underappraising these properties. And as a result, I think we undershot the market in terms of the real opportunity for comprehensive revitalization. As good as it was, it could have been better. Insufficient mixed use, just to say a little bit about that. As new urbanists, we certainly promote mixed use, but seldom were we able to achieve it. I sort of attribute that to HUD's housing-only focus, the complexity in financing mixed-use kinds of endeavors, also, again, dealing with silo-type developers who they were housing developers, not retail developers. And so yet another partnership would need to form. And then my last negative thing was sort of where we found in a couple of cases as designers, after winning the Hope 6 grant with the development team, were replaced or for, let's say, less expensive models. And I know this was an expensive program, but the reality is the product is not as good. The controls, there were no architectural design controls or urban design controls, and that poor control over quality and construction. So the results didn't totally achieve the vision in the initial thing. I want to just talk for a second about some enhancements. As we view this next life of Hope 6 after Hope 6, I think it's time for us to really acknowledge that this is both an economic development and a community development program, not just a housing program. And so we need to rebuild the infrastructure that surrounds the physical, the social, and the economic aspects of community so that we can truly create. And that requires a
real partnership, a real partnership that's suggested in some of the legislation having to do with federal, state, local, schools, community, cities, where the community and the city can focus all of its resources on addressing these challenging problems in the worst communities we're focused on. And my last point is about one size fit all. We did Hope 6 developments that had 40 units. We did Hope 6 developments that had 1,200 units. The current kind of program has a timeline that puts all of those in a one-size-fits-all kind of time frame. And so when we are criticized as a Hope 6 program for not delivering timely, I think it doesn't recognize the complexity and differences associated with those various programs. And so my proposal would be to develop a plan and a response to an OFA that is specific and customized to that location, propose a development plan, be held accountable for delivering to that development plan, but don't make it the same plan no matter where you are and no matter what the situation is.
Great, very sensible. Okay, Chicky Grayson, who is has developed some of these projects and who deals with management issues and everything else that result from that, what are your thoughts?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about brain damage, and I unfortunately learned that firsthand. Actually, that's how I met Ray. And I was consulting with someone I had worked with before, and she was now working in another city, and she was working with UDA. And I thought, boy, this isn't the person I knew. And, I mean, she was so stressed out. And several years later, when I was working on our Hope 6, I saw myself and I saw her, and I said, oh, my God, this is the same phenomenon. So at some point you get psychotic, so the answer is probably drugs, or better yet, probably disengaging somehow with a housing authority, since that seems to be the common thread, having done some Hope 6-like developments that aren't Hope 6. They seem to go smoother, and they're all hard, but they're not quite as crazy. So that would be one of the things that I would recommend. At Enterprise, which was founded by Jim Rouse, I saw a quote from Jim from a speech that he had given in 1963 before you were all born. And the last line of it says, "Do we create an environment that promotes the growth of people?" And so that's really how I try to look at our successes and our failures in Hope 6 and what we can do going forward. And I also look at it at the individual level, the neighborhood level, and then the larger community, the local government or the metropolitan area. And I'd say it's obvious the most positive thing that came out of this is that everybody right now has a cleaner, safer, better quality housing, a better community in which to live, and they have better housing. There just isn't any question about that. So from a redevelopment perspective, Hope 6 has been extremely successful. I think that downside, I think, of Hope 6, and I do also think that the neighborhoods and the cities have also gained much more in terms of being able to do other developments surrounding those communities, spurring other development. Ultimately, that has opportunities for jobs, potentially for people that are living in the communities. So I think there's been great benefit for the neighborhoods and for the city. For the people, I also think there's been great benefit, but I just don't think we've done enough in terms of the social need that people have and what we can do with regard to that. What we hear pretty much consistently is that where you have a situation of various income levels, that people live next door to each other. We can even build them so they're indistinguishable, which is great, but there isn't a lot of interaction between those people that are of lower income and those people that are higher income. Our experience happens to be comparing rental housing to home ownership, where there isn't very much discussion amongst those groups of people. And I think that also, though, I still believe that I have a short-term and a long-term view. In the short-term, I think we've been very successful. Cleaner, safer, better quality housing, better communities. The long-term view, I think the jury's certainly out. I hope we can do much to improve it, even in those communities that we've already created. And that is the sustainability of these communities over the long haul, and will people from all walks of life still be living in these communities 20 and 30 years from now, or will be somebody else be sitting here in place of us talking about how we have to do this all over again? I think not, and I hope not. I think we have been very successful on many levels, but I do think that these social issues are still very much there. And we've done two Hope Sixes, and one in which we set up a community development corporation that was a nonprofit organization. They carried out all the community and supportive services. That organization still exists today. They're doing those community and supportive services not only in the community that we created, but many other communities in the D.C. area. I have a sense that community has been achieved a greater social integration. The other one we did, the Housing Authority, said they would take care of the community and supportive services. And that has been a great disappointment, and I think that ultimately has an impact on that social integration as well. And I just want to, I'm going to stop there because I have some other comments, but I'll wait for the rest of the discussion. Thank you.
Okay. In the interest of preserving some time for general discussion and questions, comments, and input from the audience, I'm going to conflate the next two, or deflate, or whatever it is, put together the next two items. The third question, which is what's next and what do we carry forward, and the idea of a back-and-forth discussion among the panelists. So the panelists earlier expressed their willingness to interrupt each other. So in this round of comments, I'm going to ask them to do that and bounce ideas back and forth. I do want to make one comment in response to a theme that's coming through here based on a recent experience of mine, which was taking a group of British mixed-income housing developers to a series of Hope Six programs. And the ones that were succeeding the most clearly had the kind of social supported services that Chickie described in the community-based organization that did it. And the same observation we made, that was true, where there was a committed local agency on the ground all the time, becoming part of the community, social integration became very possible between very, very different income groups, but it takes work. It's not something that happens automatically, and that has been a debate here at CNU. Certainly it was at the Housing Summit, the publication of which has just come out, I've been meaning to announce.
We have extra copies here in the room.
Which was an effort to cope with the present administration's ideologies about housing. To find a middle ground for producing mixed income housing. And the debate there was, well, isn't just the physical design enough? You just provide enough diversity, that's fine, the story's over. And what I think has been said by everyone at this table is it's not. When you're dealing with extreme differences in populations, there is a whole series of supportive services that are needed to be able to make it work. And once it works, it's fine, but it needs to be done. So, moving on to the next question. Henry.
Ray, I just wanted to say that, I want to make a statement unrelated to Hope Six per se as public housing, but assuming that many of you in this audience are architects, designers, who are interested in cities, but not necessarily in lower-income housing or in that particular community, people who does that kind of work, low-income housing, tax credits, rentals, public housing, Hope Six, there are some important lessons that are applicable at a bigger scale. And that I think will provide opportunities for projects, for work going forward. There are a whole series of forces, I believe, no time to go into them this morning, that are bringing people back to the cities. Mm-hmm. Immigrants, empty nesters, middle-class minorities, people who don't want to commute long distances, medical centers, inner-city universities. You just kind of go on and on and on with the factors that are working to bring people, even the cities that we've thought of as sort of our worst cases, like Philadelphia, major renaissance going on in Philadelphia, like Pittsburgh, major sections of Pittsburgh coming back strongly, Baltimore, Johns Hopkins, the University of Maryland Medical Center area, etc. So the lessons from Hope Six, I think, that have applicability to cities include these lessons of mixed
income, very important. These lessons of kind of scale and type, how to relate to the architectural traditions of a city, stoops in Baltimore, row houses in Philadelphia, etc. They look like the city in its next iteration. Materials, amenities, linkage to commercial nodes, this very important notion in cities of defensible space, you know, kind of private entrances as opposed to putting people in position where they have to go through somebody else's space. All of these things that are design-oriented, but beyond design, you know, creating a real village with a center. And you saw in some of, you see in some of these slides that in some places that's a public library where the city has invested as part. I think schools make a lot of sense in that way because the school, the neighborhood school, can be not just the school, but it can be the library and it can be the meeting place after hours and it can be the recreation center, workout facility, walking track. It can be the job training center location as in Murphy Park in St. Louis. So there's a whole lot of lessons here that should be interesting to new urbanists apart from whether or not they're part of a Hope 6 team or not. And I just wanted to make that point.
Ray? You know, in the hopes of creating some controversy here, as I've been looking at all these slides, it is all low-rise. And the mantra of Hope 6 and of new urbanism was low-rise, high density. However, we are seeing in the renaissance of all of our cities now high-rise residential. Just go out the door here and you'll see the way that cities are re-inhabiting themselves. And it's good urbanism, but it is high-rise. So I would posit, because there was some debate at some points in the CNU's life about whether or not high-rise buildings are new urbanists at all, I would say, number one, if you're interested in the revitalization of urban centers, you have to reinvestigate the typology of high-rise buildings and how they meet the street and how they create neighborhoods, how they create safe places. But fortuitously, it actually solves the biggest dilemma one of the dilemmas that Hope 6 was confronting, which was, gee, we don't have enough space for one-to-one replacement. Well, if we throw out the preconception that we're dealing with bungalows and townhouses only, which is what the vast majority of these images that are flashing in front of you are, and say, no, cities are places, clearly cities. And now, it does depend on context, because there are some kind of semi-suburban public housing locations. They need to fit their context. But also, new urbanism needs to push the context. We need to intensify density at transit nodes and in urban centers. And we can no longer afford to have any ambiguity about whether we are for or against high-rise buildings. We've got to be for them if you're for transit, if you're for inner city revitalization, and if you're for affordable housing. Excuse me, it's time to move on.
If you can do it while still deconcentrating.
Well, that's the whole point, is that if you can create enough density on the site, you can create the mix and the one-to-one, as opposed to what we had to sacrifice in Hope 6 was we gave up on one-to-one because we weren't willing to go to the density.
You can do what you're talking about, but you have to be really good at the management of the buildings, and that's
what?
Management of the building, and that's part of what happened in public housing was when the rules changed in the 1960s and 70s that said you must pick from the poorest of the poor. So we had entire buildings where there were no dual-headed households, zero, not one household that was dual-headed. Few examples of people who get up every day and go to work. Then later, the growth of a drug-related population, and so the buildings just got out of hand. It doesn't sound like PC to say it. It just happens to be practical facts of management that you have to have mixed income. That's where mixed income becomes more important.
But mixed income will work in high rises.
Oh yeah. No, I'm not saying that. I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying we need to go to high rises, but mixed income becomes more important when you do. And management becomes more important when you do. And the example, the perfect example of where high-rises works is New York City.
Yes.
In New York City, the Public Housing Authority cannot understand the public housing crisis in other parts of the country. It's its own place because all of their high-rises work. And one of the reasons they work is because of rent control in New York. It was such that people never left their apartments. When the rules changed in other parts of America and suddenly the buildings started to fill with only the poor, in New York, people didn't leave their apartments. They didn't dare. So we had mixed ethnicity, mixed income forever, and the buildings worked.
I'm going to break all protocol here.
Can I just...
I'm going to break all protocol because I want to follow up on... I'm going to stop being a moderator and being a participant.
You can't stand it anymore.
Try to stop me. Try to stop me.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, please.
I just want to echo it because I think it's so correct. And I think that probably the unfortunate thing is when we started the Hope 6 program in the mid to late 90s, the markets in our urban areas weren't that strong, particularly in some of the, you know, blue-collar cities that we had previously, where the jobs were previously. And I'll use one of our developments that we did in Baltimore City as a perfect example. It's 32 acres. We have 8 units per acre there now. It used to be 80 units per acre. And we were proud of it at the time. I'm not proud of it anymore. But the problem is the lag time between designing the plan and actually being able to start it was 5 years.
It was built in
2001. It was planned in 1996. So today that site should have greater density, and it would be very successful. It would be even more successful.
Mm-hmm. But the progression.
No, I don't. If it's got home ownership in it, you'd have to buy 185 units. But the
progression, it is moving towards, you know, we're at 65 units per acre.
I think that's I just wanted to echo that. I think that that's really important.
We also have a Hope 6 that doubled the density. And this is in a city that demanded one-for-one replacement.
Where's that?
Washington, D.C., Arthur Kapper, Carrollsburg. And in that case, it was the right thing to do because location, it had transit, mm-hmm. it had a great housing market, and so the real estate values really supported it.
What's the height?
The height's going to go really, you know, 4-6 stories, depending, even 8 stories in some cases, but also row houses. So there's a mix going to over 1,400 units on that site.
I just wanted, just as a comment on this, I agree 100% with increasing the density and going to high-rise buildings. I think we have to be careful as the one-size-fits-all model here, of course. As new urbanists, we would, of course, do that. But let's just echo that. It's also a distinct – we find a distinct difference in who the market is. And there's no question that severely distressed families with a lot of kids is a more difficult proposition to put in a high-rise than empty nesters or young adults moving in, and who in many Hope 6 cases were the most adventurous pioneers moving into high-income people moving into those programs. So I agree with what's been said. I think is maybe worth summing up that, first of all, Peter's taking us back in his comments to the regional vision and seeing how all of these pieces fit together, and then looking, as Henry pointed out, to seeing these redevelopments not as housing developments but as developments that are creating neighborhoods with libraries and schools and public spaces and social spaces which create focuses for interaction. And then thirdly, looking for a more diverse range of housing types and building types which respond to different markets, still responding to context to get the ratio of change to open up the whole possibility. So those are three answers to the next question. Who's going to come with the next answer?
We should ask.
We will. Yeah, we will. I want to see anybody else on the panel, then we'll open it up.
I just want to make one other quick point. I know that the new urbanism is not strictly about cities and infill. There are many new urbanist communities and suburbs and beyond. But to the degree that the new urbanists are dedicated to care about cities, then the new urbanists also need to care about the schools, not as design propositions, but as the quality of schools in America, of public schools in central cities. Because most of what we want to accomplish on the design front, on the community front, the residential complex front, cannot be done without schools that parents are willing to bring their children to and families are willing to come back to. So it really is critical. And where these can be done together, like Centennial in Atlanta, like the Portman development at Eastlake in Atlanta, now we're really making progress.
Well,
involved.
But hold on, respond to that. Were you going to go to the different topic?
Go ahead.
Okay, so this opens up another great topic of controversy, which is some of us in the new urbanism favor school vouchers for low-income communities or school vouchers based on geography, i.e., the city has been disadvantaged. The middle class has the wealth to move to the suburbs in order to chase down good public schools. The cities don't have, people living in the cities don't have that advantage. One great way to spur urbanism in general, and people moving back to the cities, is to take away the penalty that they pay in terms of the kinds of schools they go to. Why not, instead of, why not school vouchers that are targeted to urban areas and or to income population?
Peter, what I like better than vouchers is magnet schools and charter schools in the physical places where, in the center of the city, where you can get really quality schools and outside the box of the school bureaucracy and so forth. I just don't know of enough about how vouchers actually work in cities. There have been some well-publicized experiments like Milwaukee that I want to understand better. But the fear of vouchers is that literally you empty out the central city schools and neighborhoods, and that's what I think we need to know more about.
Paul, well, for those of you who would like to make some comments, I'm going to bring the microphone.
Ray, I'm just sitting here musing about the enormous kind of professional development challenge here, whether that's the development of housing authority staff who can work on these with success, or whether it's private developers, or whether it's...
That was an implosion.
It was close, Ray.
We have a lot of professional development needs, it seems to me, at various levels that we've only been partially attentive to, and I just reflect on how much more we have to do to get people skilled enough to carry out these very challenging assignments.
Okay, great. Robert Fishman.
Thank you. And thanks to the panel. I'm a great admirer of Hope 6 and the achievements of the people on it. But I do want to ask a kind of negative question. And maybe the one thing that really surprised me about the whole Hope 6 process was the strong resistance and organization by people who had been living in the projects against the demolitions, in a sense. And I just thought, as I think we all do, that these were disasters and everybody wanted to get out and to get out as soon as possible. And even if they had to have vouchers, they would want them. And it did suggest to me that maybe we didn't really understand the community inside these projects. Wow. And I was just wondering about...
I think this is an issue of trust.
Yeah.
You know, I remember going to Philadelphia and... saying, I'm from Washington, I'm here to help you, but I'm going to tear down all your housing, trust me. You know, and it was literally a riot. And so it took years of building that trust so that people could understand that there was some, because we're asking residents of public housing about their opinion about where they'd like to live and how they'd like to live, when they've never had any choice or been asked that question about anything up to now. So it was truly a trust issue that with that fear being removed and seeing progress and how the rest of the program developed throughout the country, people were able to see examples of positive things happening, and I think that helped.
Just as a last-minute footnote to that, Chickie this morning told us about the New Orleans experience where there has been a lot of national objection to tearing down the public housing projects. The resident survey of 80% of the residents, 80% wanted the projects torn down, did not want to move back to it. So I think there's a difference between the perceptions of advocates, perception of residents, mm-hmm. and fundamentally this question of trust.
Well, and I think I'm Michael O'Neill from AARP, but I'm representing sort of my urban sociology background in having grown up in St. Louis and seen the consequences of Pruitt-Igoe. But I think, to go to your point beforehand, that we didn't get the opinions of people before we moved them into public housing either, nor did we recognize the neighborhoods and the social capital that existed and that was disrupted when we moved people into public housing. But the key point, I think we talked about moving to opportunity. I think one of the points that we have to recognize in this HOPE 6 project is that we need to put the people who are at moderate means living in HOPE 6 and people who are living in market rate conditions of HOPE 6, because those are the folks that are really accruing a lot of the benefits of HOPE 6. They have been relocated to center cities with amenities, with the transportation pieces. So we need to study those folks as well to show what benefits accumulated to them, not just to the poor.
Yeah, I think that's focus groups.
Hi, Ed Steinfeld, SUNY Buffalo, School of Architecture. I've been studying housing in Denmark and Sweden, and I have learned that in Denmark there's a model of housing which many of you might have heard of called co-housing. And in Denmark, the subsidized housing is all built using the co-housing model, and I think that model is a very good, very compatible with a new urbanist approach to design and planning. And I would urge those of you contemplating, suggesting, and recommending for the future of reinvigorating the HOPE 6 project to look at that as an organizational tool where communities essentially become communities before they actually start building and designing.
I think it's really worth looking at. I view it in market terms. There is a niche of people in Denmark and elsewhere and in this country who want the kind of almost communal living that the co-housing model represents, which I personally find very appealing. But I don't know what the market slice is that wants that experience. And so I'm a little sober about understanding how large that phenomenon could be in the kind of context in which we're discussing.
The co-housing model is evolving, and we tend to think about it as a sort of like 60s-oriented cooperative community, but it's really changing because now that they've adopted it for every publicly subsidized housing project, they now have a much more diverse range of projects, gotcha. Which have a much different range of cooperativeness, you might say, or but everybody knows each other. That's the important thing. The people become a community in the sense that they know each other, and then they feel comfortable about moving into a new context.
The college kids are now doing it through Facebook, where they pick their roommates before they go to school.
Hi, I'm Monica Carney. I work for DPZ in Charlotte, and I've been kind of involved in Charlotte and trying to figure out local policies, so this isn't exactly a HOPE 6 question, but we're really struggling with the under 30% of the median income population, and there's a lot of resistance to adopting a complete mixed income policy because people are saying, oh, well, our need isn't necessarily 60 to 80% because that's naturally occurring in other places in the city. Our need is for 30%. And I'm just asking y'all, I guess, what your suggestions are, or projects that you know, or policies that you know that can kind of answer that and that I can come back with as a solution.
I would say that we need to think of public housing as part, and public housing sites as part of the answer in what is a mix of housing types that a city must have. So if you start with the most fundamental and primitive form of housing needed, which is shelter beds for the homeless, and then go through the next step, which might be supportive housing, housing for homeless people transitioning out of homelessness with services, and then public housing has a piece in there, and subsidized rentals have a piece, low-income housing tax credits and other approaches to subsidize rentals, and in that, along that continuum toward home ownership, entry-level and move-up homes and so forth. Cities that have, you know, an entire range of housing policies create the right supply for workers, for people struggling up from homelessness, for the elderly, for the disabled, for the working poor, etc. So you really need to look at an entire spectrum. And there's some cities that are doing this and doing it well. Chicago, for example, Mayor Daley has a kind of a mantra, almost, you know, his speeches on housing say, we want to end chronic homelessness in 10 years. We want to build, renovate 25,000 units of public housing. We want to add 48,000 units of affordable housing. You know, that's Mayor Daley's sort of strategy in Chicago. Bloomberg in New York, with Sean Donovan as the public housing director, similarly, so good, you know, important metrics. Mayor Menino in Boston has restructured the city government so that housing has a higher place in the mayor's cabinet. That would be my answer to an entire range.
And I would just add that when you're dealing with different populations, again, these community and supportive services are really critical to the success of the entire development. So taking, you know, I agree with Henry totally, you really do have to have a whole range of incomes, but when you are trying to reach people of very low incomes, then those supportive services are going to be critical to the success of the overall development as well.
I would like to ask the panelists to comment a little bit more on some of the proposed changes for Hope 6 and what you think about them, particularly the one-to-one replacement. Do any of you think that that might be a problem if it is imposed across all projects, and particularly in some places where high-rise or higher-rise buildings might be more difficult? The other question, I believe that I heard that there's some proposed management changes, or at least to make it more difficult to exclude some of the former residents of public housing. And might that create problems, or do you think it's a good thing?
I wanted to start with some startling information and of great concern, and that is that basically the allowance that you get from the Housing Authority for the public housing portion of your Hope 6 sites has continued to be cut over the past several years. And so it's now about 85% of what it's supposed to be, which means that everybody that did these, they had agreements with HUD and with their lenders that if HUD started doing this, really reducing the amount of funding that they were providing to make sure that you could operate the buildings properly for the people that live there, that you had a plan, you had to have a plan in place that over 3 years you would eventually have higher income people, and it would not necessarily be public housing. And so that's something that everybody should be aware of. We're in danger right now of losing the housing for very low-income people. With that, the Section 8 vouchers is the second problem that we currently have. The Section 8 program has been reduced. People are getting letters now that I think this is property-based, probably not individual-based, but that instead of getting their year-to-year Section 8 contract, they'll get the contract for a year, but the contract will say that they only have 5 months of revenue for that year. Mm-hmm. So I think we're in some pretty difficult spaces here with regard to the funding that's available right now, and hopefully that will change in November.
Speaking to the gentleman's specific 2 points on one-for-one and rules for coming back, I understand that as proposed now, bill says one-for-one replacement in hard units, but not necessarily on site. So you can replace as a housing authority with hard units elsewhere. That's a hard thing to do, but it is more manageable, in my opinion, than saying one-for-one on that site. Mm-hmm. Because by definition, I mean, if the site is built out with public housing, then where do you have the room for the mixed income and so forth? So I think that's a forward step. And it might be also useful to replace one-for-one with the units that were actually units and not what's vacant and burned out counted as units, because that raises the barrier for public housing authorities. The second point on rules coming back, I mean, we stiffened the rules over the last few years. One strike and you're out. If family is doing drugs, they're out. Very, very tough, because mothers and fathers can't always control what their children are doing and so forth. So sometimes, you know, really sad cases develop from it. But we have stiffened the rules. I would say
the rules are stiff enough and ought not be further stiffened for people to come back to Hope 6. In other words, if the rules are good enough for public housing, that ought to be the rules that apply, and not new and stiffer rules to get back into public housing. So that would be my sense.
Okay, well, we've long overstayed our welcome. We're going to do just a couple more questions. If we have a 30-second question and a 45-second response, we might be able to stay on schedule.
Hi, I'm Peter French, a New Urban community developer, and a quick question. New Urbanism is, if you think, a sustainable alternative to some broken design, and I think used in that context to try to fix Hope 6, and you have environmental sustainability, social sustainability, economic sustainability. The pictures, which are very dramatic, of 20-story towers being demolished and sent to a dump someplace is not in any way environmental. And so how do you address maybe retrofitting some of these really broken urban spaces, utilizing what's there already, as opposed to carting off either high-rise or mid-rise buildings and throwing them all away?
Well, the reality is that most of those units are designed in ways where the room, I think you said in your speech last night, Henry, some of the rooms are just uninhabitable. A family can't sit around their dining room table. And so there's a structural dilemma here of reuse. There's also a cost issue of reuse. One of the things that Hope 6 and affordable housing has to do is make sure that it seeks the most efficient use of public dollars to get the largest number of units. And if you're spending more to rehab than you are to build new, that's in some way taking away from possibilities for additional public housing. So there's obviously a balance point that needs to be looked at. And of course, there are ways of recycling existing building materials, even if you do go to demolition. So I think that's a very case-specific piece of analysis that needs to be done one-on-one.
But clearly going forward, everything that we do now needs to be environmentally sustainable, and it really hasn't been a focus of the program up until recently. And so because these are homes and developments that are going to be there for hopefully centuries. And
Peter, many of you are design folks, architects. I don't know what people were thinking when they built these buildings.
Yeah.
I don't know who was in charge. I don't know what they possibly could have been thinking.
The modern architects.
Yeah, the modern architects.
The modernists.
But to build buildings in Chicago where the only way you can get from room to room is to go outside onto breezeways that are covered with a chain-link fence, not indoors. I mean, Chicago, middle of the night, to go next door. You have to go outside into zero-degree weather and wind. It just didn't make any sense. Hallways that absolutely could not be secured. Could not be secured. I mean, everything funneling through a place where the gang members could frisk women as they come in at their pleasure. You know, drug markets run in the hallways by drug lords in prison, but running their gangs from a distance. You know, parapets where literally, the police would not drive onto the plaza, to the public space, because snipers with weapons could target them from the high-rise sites and shoot from those distances onto the vast open spaces that you were targeting. So the police didn't go, period, at all, zero. The buildings were in charge of whatever gang lord chose to run it. These were designed to be abused that way. Central core elevators that didn't work. So mothers had no choice but to walk up 20 stories with groceries and children in their arms. 20 stories up because the elevators were knocked out and never maintained and never protected. And hallways and outdoor walkways with lighting systems that literally, as when they were fixed in the afternoon, would be broken by that night because the gang members wanted them dark. So they came and knocked them out, just knocked them one after the other. Those were designed to not work.
Okay, we have the final 30-second question.
Hi. Michael Casillas. I'm a mixed-income and mixed-use urban developer with either the privilege or the curse of operating right here in central Austin. I've developed tax credit, been on a team to develop, over 200 units of mixed-income tax credit development, and I've developed a 3-unit subdivision where two-thirds of the development was affordable, and I must say it's much easier to develop larger projects than, you know, the down, you know, the urban infill projects. And yet, for urbanists, you know, shouldn't we be promoting more the down-to-earth? I'm totally for high-rises in downtown and on the commercial corridors, but within the neighborhoods where there is the most opportunity for density in the urban core, where does Hope 6 and tax credit and affordable housing go to really make promote the smaller developments versus, of course, the large multi-million-dollar, you know, very complex financial transactions?
Well, those financing methods need scale,
right?
So you need it. You need the tax credits or any of the federal programs. The brain damage, the lasagna financing, as they call.
I think we see an awful lot of community development corporations very creative. One of the products of this whole process has been an army of people with special skills in mixed income, mixed finance, financing at all scales. And some of the best work that we've seen has been done by small community development corporations, or not necessarily small, but community development corporations, in which it's one-by-one infill or a little 10-unit development here, or a little 20-unit development over there, done in dialogue with the community because it's a community-based development corporation. So it seems to me to continue the tax credit programs and others that can get funds to those kinds of entities would be a way around that.
And we've absolutely had success doing that. I guess my comment then is just a recommendation that if we want to promote more urbanist, more infill, that even the existing programs can go a little further to you know, awarding credits for, you know, 12 units or 30 units versus 36 and above.
Great point, because what we find is many of the community development corporations had to jump through hoops, flying trapezes while turning somersaults in the air to be able to figure out how to get the funding programs tailored to their particular needs. Well, we're at the end of this session. One of the products of this session, we hope, will be a book published by CNU on lessons learned from Hope 6. The panelists are going to continue to work for another 20 minutes or so to see what we think that book ought to become. Thank you all for participating, and thank you, panel.